The following is a lecture given by His Holiness Radhanath Swami Maharaj from Bhagavad Gita as it is, Chapter 9, Text 13, recorded on April 25th, 2000 at Chicago.
Mahatmanastu mam bharata daivim prakritim ashritah vajantyananyamanasau kyatvabhutadim avyayam. O son of Pritha, those who are not deluded, the great souls, are under the protection of the divine nature. They are fully engaged in devotional service because they know me as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, original and inexhaustible. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. In this verse, the description of a Mahatma is clearly given. The first sign of a Mahatma is that he is already situated in the divine nature. He is not under the control of material nature. And how is this affected? That is explained in the 7th chapter. One who surrenders unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, at once becomes freed from the control of material nature. That is the qualification. One can become free from the control of material nature as soon as he surrenders his soul to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That is the preliminary formula. Being marginal potency, as soon as the living entity is freed from the control of material nature, he is put under the guidance of the spiritual nature. The guidance of the spiritual nature is called Daivi Prakriti, divine nature. So when one is promoted in that way by surrendering unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one attains the stage of a great soul, Mahatma. The Mahatma does not divert his attention to anything outside Krishna, because he knows perfectly well that Krishna is the original Supreme Person, the cause of all causes. There is no doubt about it. Such a Mahatma or great soul develops through association with other Mahatmas or pure devotees. Pure devotees are not even attracted by Krishna's other features, such as the four-armed Mahavishnu. They are simply attracted to the two-armed form of Krishna. They are not attracted to other features of Krishna, nor are they concerned with any form of a demigod or of a human being. They meditate only upon Krishna, in Krishna consciousness. They are always engaged in the unswerving service of the Lord, in Krishna consciousness. Om Ajnanimitandasya Jnananjana Chalakaya Chakshurum Militam Jena Tasmai Sri Gurve Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manovishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Tadati Svapadantikam Pandeham Sri Guru Sri Juta Padakamalam Sri Gurum Vaishnavascha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakan Vitamscha
Hey Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dinabandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostate Radha Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Anushakam Padarubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Vayasha Patitanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namah Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Shivashati Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
O son of Prita, those who are not deluded, the great souls, are under the protection of the divine nature. They are fully engaged in devotional service because they know me as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, original and inexhaustible. Krishna is the Paramatma. He is the Supreme Soul of all souls. As the Upanishads declare, Nityo Nityanam Chaitanas Chaitananam Eko Bahunam Yobidadati Kaman. There is one Supreme Soul. There is innumerable eternal souls. But all of those innumerable eternal souls are dependent upon and controlled by that one Supreme Soul. That is the difference between the Jivatma and the Paramatma. Both Jivatma and Paramatma qualitatively are Satchit Ananda, eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. But the Paramatma is all-knowing. He is the source of everything that exists. He never comes under the control of his own energies. Mayadhyakshena prakriti suyate sacharacharam. He is the controller of all energies. But the Jivatma, being infinitesimal by nature, has free will, as does the Paramatma. However, if that Jivatma misuses his free will to want to try to enjoy separate from the service of the Paramatma, then he comes under the control of the external illusory energy, also called Maya Shakti. This free will is eternally inherent within every living soul. Why does the Jivatma want to try to enjoy separate from Krishna? This is described in Vedanta Sutra, Parashya Shaktir Vibhadaiva Shruyate. Krishna has multifarious energies, and Anandamayo Vyashat, of the spirit souls, they are all eternal, and they are all seeking unlimited pleasure. That pleasure has its origin in loving Krishna. However, if we want to find pleasure in any other pursuit other than serving Krishna and loving Krishna, then we are cast under this Maya Shakti or illusory energy. Because in the spiritual world, there's simply no place for anyone who wants to do anything but serve and love Krishna. Because that's what everyone else is doing. There's no space, there's no facility to try to find happiness in anything else. Therefore, in this fool's paradise, which is the material, illusory energy, there is majority of people are trying to find happiness apart from service to God. And they have created entire civilizations to facilitate that pursuit. So we come here by our free will, and we remain here by our free will. So there is always a difference between the Paramatma, or the Supreme Soul, and the Jivatma, the controlled soul. However, when that Jivatma turns to the Paramatma with sincerity and faith, that Jivatma becomes Mahatma, or a great soul. Never Paramatma, Supreme Soul. There's a difference between being great and being supreme. Or Jiva, insignificant. Jiva means insignificant. Maha means great. So in our insignificant position, we can become great, Mahatma, when we turn to God. And what is the qualification of such a Mahatma? It is explained here that it is a person who is no longer under the control of the illusory energy, but he is under the control, or she is under the control, of the divine nature. That nature which is ever facilitating higher and higher levels of devotion. And the illusory energy, or Maya, is always facilitating greater and greater degrees and of variegated means of forgetting Krishna and trying to enjoy separate from Krishna. Look in our society. You're living in one small city, in one small planet, in one small universe. How many varieties of ways are there to try to enjoy? Can you count them? Can anyone count them? We have some very postgraduate computer scientists here. Even with all the most highly developed software and hardware, they cannot calculate how many ways there are to enjoy and suffer in this world in forgetfulness of Krishna. So that is the Maya Shakti. She's providing this. When you come under the control of the divine, of the material nature, the external nature, then this is what happens. His Holiness Nityodita Maharaj was just telling me of a tape of Srila Prabhupada, extraordinary tape, where one young lady asked Srila Prabhupada in Hawaii, if Krishna is all good, why... He said, just because you pass stool, does that mean you're bad? The young lady was shocked. When Srila Prabhupada looks at you very seriously and asks this question, it's not an easy thing to answer. She didn't answer. He repeated, answer. Because you pass stool, does that mean you are a bad person? So bad things can come from good people. But in Krishna's case, he is all good, and everything coming from him is good. Actually, this material energy is all good. It is a reflection of the spiritual energy. It is good because it has a good purpose. But when we are under the trappings of this material energy, then it appears very, very bad. Just like for good citizens, the prison house is a very good thing because it keeps the society very safe. But for criminals, the prison house is a very bad place. So is the jailhouse good or bad? For the criminals, it's bad. For the well-behaved people, it's very good. So similarly, this material existence, it has its purpose to reform us, to frustrate our false hopes, to to try to enjoy life separate from our constitutional nature of serving God. And this is not some egocentric idea of God to prove himself to be supreme. It's his compassion and mercy. He wants to give every spirit soul unlimited bliss. All we have to do is say, Krishna, I'm yours, with a whole heart. And he gives us in return unlimited spiritual ecstasy forever. And when we deprive ourselves of that, that's our problem, not Krishna's problem, our problem. But out of his compassion, he wants to teach us. When a parent sees a child has potential for a bright future, but that child is wasting its future away and even jeopardizing its whole life by engaging in mischievous criminal lethargic activities, then what does the parent do? The parent tells the child, don't do this, do this. And sometimes the parent takes away things that the child wants. Takes away cigarettes. Takes away the friendship of people taking drugs and alcohol. Now to the child, this is punishment. It's cruel. But to a sane person, it's love. So the sufferings of this world are actually the acts of love of God to teach us a good lesson of what we're supposed to do and how we're supposed to do it so we can receive the transcendental gift that Krishna wants to give all of us. It is our rightful inheritance to be ecstatic eternally in the spiritual world. Aham bija pratapita, because Krishna is our father. So the Mahatma is that person in this world who makes that decision and declares it boldly that I am Krishna's servant and my life is for Krishna's pleasure. And that devotee is reciprocating with Krishna, and Krishna is reciprocating with that devotee by always protecting that devotee personally. And in this world, there are such amazing varieties of ways to try to enjoy. What you see with your gross eyes in the society today is really cheap, low class, downtrodden enjoyment. When you look at the movie stars in their Hollywood mansions, that is just low grade enjoyment. Much higher than that is in the heavenly planets. And higher than that is the planets of the munis and the sages. But even those pleasures, which are intense trappings, only take our mind away from our real purpose. In Srimad Bhagavatam, there is a very famous and instructive story about Ambarish Maharaj. He was a grihastha with wife, children, occupation as a king. King means politics, means management, means all sorts of military skills required. Not things that you would ordinarily think to be very spiritual. But he spiritualized everything because he did it all in the service of God. It is not so much what you do, but the consciousness in which you do it that determines whether you are material or spiritual. Ambarish Maharaj, like Arjuna, was fighting battles. But he was purely on the spiritual platform. Arjuna is a Mahatma shooting arrows in people's body and tearing their arms and heads off. You read Mahabharata, you see what Arjuna did to people. And Bhima. Bhima was a Mahatma. Bhima was ripping people's hearts out with his bare hands. He was crushing every bone in people's bodies with his club. It's not the ordinary idea of Mahatma. But he wasn't a criminal. He was doing it to protect the innocent in the service of Krishna. And usually you think of Mahatma as somebody who's very peaceful, very tolerant, doesn't eat very much. Bhima was famous as Vrikodar, which means one whose belly is burning with hunger like a wolf. He could eat huge sums. When he was in Ekachakra, the birthplace of Nityananda Prabhu, the yuga before Nityananda Prabhu, Bakasura, he was a big, big demon. And they would have to, the people of the town would have to sacrifice every fortnight one of their children to him, with a whole big wagon full. Not these Kali Yuga wagons, but a Dwarpa Yuga wagon. That means bigger than these 18-wheel semi-trailers. Full of food, mountains of food, prasad. And Bakasura would eat the whole cart of prasad, and then he would eat the driver. That was his dessert. Human blood and flesh. Very, very nice. You laugh. But actually, the best tasting flesh and blood is human. It's the most tender. If you're a meat eater. And that's why there's rakshashas. They know the secret. But they don't understand that what tastes best to the senses is sometimes the most sinful things. It feels very nice to get intoxicated. It feels very nice to have sex life anytime you like it. But it's sinful and it binds you in terrible, terrible sufferings, as does eating meat. So Bhima, he was so hungry that actually Kunti asked, why are you crying? They were incognito living at the house of some village people of Ekachakra, and the lady was crying. Kunti Devi said, why you are crying? He said, my only son, there's rotation, and now it's my family's turn to give the son to drive the cart to Bakasura. Because Bakasura has agreed that he will stop harassing the village if we send him this offering once every fortnight. So I will lose my only son. Kunti said, don't worry. I have 5 sons. I'll send one of mine. And I won't lose him either. So I'm living in your house. So let me spring. So she sent Bhima. And all the way up he was eating the food. By the time it reached Bakasura's abode, there was hardly anything left on the cart. He was a big eater. He ate the whole cart. And he was just finishing up. When Bakasura saw him, he was outraged. What is this driver? He ate my whole... I'm a Rakshasa. He ate my whole offering. He was so angry. He challenged Bhima. He came charging at him. But Bhima wasn't finished eating prasad yet. With his left hand, he just held Bakasura off while he finished. Then he washed his hands. Then they started to fight. It was a great fight. It lasted a long time. But ultimately, Bhima saying he was so powerful that not only did he defeat Bakasura, but Bakasura's body was unrecognizable. His head, his arms, his legs, they were all punched so hard that they went into his torso. So he was just like a big Rakshasa ball of blood. So you think, this is what Mahatma is? Yes, this is Mahatma. Because he did it for Krishna. It's not that you can go killing people and overeating for Krishna, but it was his service. He was a Kshatriya. He was meant to protect. He did nothing for his own personal self-interest. He had to eat that much because that's what he needed to be strong for his service. So Ambarish Maharaj was a king. But everything he did for the benefit of others. He was so compassionate. He was so sacrificial. Such a Vaishnava is willing to die 1,000 times to benefit one person's life. That is Vaishnava. Ambarish Maharaj, illustrating this principle, he fasted an Ekadasi fast for 1 full year in a place called Madhuban, which is in Brajabhumi. This Ekadasi fast he performed for 1 year, every Ekadasi. No food, no, not even a drop of water. And his whole family, they all performed that fast along with him. Why did he do it? He was already pure in heart. He was already self-realized. He didn't have to do this tapasya. Because whatever the leader does, common people will follow in his footsteps. Yad yaracharati sreshtas tatad evetirochana sayat pramanam kurute lokas taranuvartate. And not only that, whatever the leader does, that karma or the spiritual credits influence the entire society of his kingdom. If a leader engages in sinful activities, those sins get handed down to everyone he's responsible in leading for. If the president or prime minister engages in sinful activities, we all get affected by that. We all get part of that karma. Hare Krishna. That's why this democracy, you have to think very carefully before you vote. And not only that, but 1/6 of the sins of the accumulated society, the leader has to take on that much karma. So it's reciprocal. So Ambarish Maharaj was performing this Ekadasi fast, forsaking food and water for 1 year, each and every Ekadasi. Why? Because he wanted to give those spiritual credits to all the souls in his kingdom so that they can be prosperous and make proper spiritual progress. This is compassion. This is love. Although he was a simple man. So just when he was about to break the fast, one great yogi who had perfected the art of mysticism, his name is Durvas Muni. He's a partial expansion of Lord Shiva. He came, but at that time, he was not practicing devotional service. He was practicing mysticism. And through his mysticism, he could perform all sorts of extraordinary miracles. Now, this is sense gratification, to perform miracles. You think it's sense gratification to smoke a cigarette, or to eat a piece of meat, or to listen to some classical rock and roll music or jazz music or gazelles?
Gazelles?
Gazelle is a type of animal, like a buffalo, but... it's Hindi love songs. What?
Ghazal.
Like guzzling.
Yes, ghazal. I'm sorry for my improper pronunciation. But the fact that I don't pronounce it properly means I most likely I don't listen to it. These things might give a little pleasure. Power, being a CEO in a big corporation, or being the master of my house. But these types of pleasures are nothing compared to what the mystics enjoy, where they can actually create things with their hands. And you want gold? Gold. And everyone's going, oh, Bhagawan. You are my Lord. You are the Supreme. You are blessed. That sense gratification, that feeling of power, control, that feeling of prestige. What to speak of the power to destroy? Such persons can create fire, wind, hurricanes just by their best by chanting a mantra. Can heal the sick. Could destroy the wicked just by chanting a mantra. So Durvas Muni had these powers in super excellent quantities. And he was known for that. So he came to Ambarish's place and he said, I would like some prasad. And Ambarish, being a Vaishnav, was always very grateful for any opportunity to serve another person. What to speak of a great person like Ambarish, like Durvas Muni. He said, yes, of course. We will have a wonderful prasad feast prepared for you. Durvas Muni said, first, I must take my bath in Jamuna and do my sandhya. So he went to Jamuna, and as he was doing his sandhya, he immersed himself in samadhi. Meanwhile, the appropriate time, the Ekadasi, the Parana, when you have to break the fast by a particular time, otherwise all the benefits of the fast are negated. Now, the negation of the fast means all he did for a full year of tapasya for the benefits of his citizens would be nullified if he didn't break the fast by a particular moment, titi. He was thinking, it's not proper for a host to eat or drink anything before the guests are served. But at the same time, Durvas Muni's in samadhi, and there's only seconds left. So he had an idea, and he consulted with the local Brahmins and ministers, and they all agreed that taking a little bit of Charanamrit is simultaneously breaking fast and not breaking fast. So he took just one tiny morsel of Charanamrit. Durvas Muni's mystic powers is he could actually know what people were doing, even though he had no direct sensory perception. He was sitting in samadhi in Jamuna, and he could actually experience the reality that Ambarish just took a drop of Charanamrit. How many of you could do that? Does any of you know whether the cooks are eating anything right now. They're sitting down here. We're just ordinary. He's extraordinary. So he was very angry. He was so angry, he came charging to Ambarish Maharaj. And he said, "You call yourself a Vaishnava? You cannot even control your senses. You cannot even restrain your tendencies to properly serve a guest that has come to your house. You are a fallen, wicked soul. You deserve to die." Hare Krishna, he was angry. And when mystics get angry, it's a very dangerous situation. I have seen with my eyes. Durvas Muni took a hair from his head. He has long, matted hair. He took one of those hairs and he dashed it to the ground with a mantra. And from that hair was born a fiery demon that was so big and powerful that it had the strength to devour the entire universe. That fiery demon began to roar. And to Vasmuni's order, he charged at Ambarish Maharaj. What did Ambarish Maharaj do? Did he run away? Did he try to take hairs out of his head and create another fiery demon? He just folded his palms and he was ready for death. He didn't mind. He just prayed to Krishna that you are my Lord. This body belongs to you. This life is your property. You can do whatever you like with it. If you want to destroy it, then I'm happy. Take it. If you want to protect it, then what can this fiery demon do to disturb me? I am yours, Krishna. Whatever is your will, let that be done. Because of his humility and his surrender, the Lord, who is the Paramatma within everyone's heart, is conscious of every desire, every thought, every word, and every action of every living entity in all of creation, including you and me. How many thoughts have you had in your life? Computer man, can you calculate? How many thoughts have you had in your life? Countless. How many thoughts have all living entities in the history of this universe had accumulated? Can Microsoft create a software to calculate that? It's unfathomable. But yet, this is just one tiny little universe. There's quadrillions of universes within the cosmic manifestation. And there is innumerable living entities in every universe. And the Paramatma has full recollection of every thought, every word, every feeling, and every action of every living entity in the entire history. He's fully aware of it. He doesn't even have to think for 1 second to remember what was done 100 billion years ago by somebody in his mind. He's all-knowing. He's Abhigya and Swarat. And he's reciprocating with our desires. He will protect us, or he will just let us go on in the forest of material illusion according to our desires. So he heard Ambarish Maharaj's prayer. And he sent from Vaikuntha his Sudarshan Chakra. Hare Krishna. The Sudarshan Chakra came charging at this fiery demon. And although this demon had the power to devour a universe, he was no match to the Lord's weapon. He was immediately destroyed. Then the Sudarshan Chakra came to Durvas Muni. Durvas Muni, great mystic, he knew there was no hairs he could pull out of his head to protect him from Sudarshan Chakra. It's the end. All he could do was run for his life. When Ambarish was being threatened by a life-threatening condition, he just folded his palms and prayed, Krishna, you can do whatever you like. When Durvas Muni was threatened, he ran away. And when running wasn't fast enough, he began to fly. Not like an airplane, not like a rocket ship, but he can go from planet to planet in a matter of minutes. That's how fast he could fly. Hare Krishna. And he was going as fast as he could. That is the difference between a great mystic and a Vaishnava. Bajahure mana Sri Nanda Nandana Abhaya Charana Ravindare. One who takes shelter of the lotus feet of Sri Nandanandana, he becomes fearless because he's not attached to anything except the will of Krishna. Durvas went to Indraloka. Indra saw Sudarshan Chakra coming. He said, go somewhere else. I cannot help you, my friend. He went to Brahmaloka, the highest planet in the material world. Abramabhuvanaloka punaravartanojana. Krishna says the highest planet in the material world is Brahmaloka. Lowest is Patalaloka. Brahmaloka to Lord Brahma, the father of every living being within this particular universe we're living in. He fell at Brahma's feet. Brahma saw Sudarshan Chakra coming. He said, there's nothing I have the power to help you with. Then he went to Lord Shiva. He went to Shiva's loka. That's beyond this material world. He fell at the feet of Lord Shiva. And Lord Shiva said, there is only one person who can save you from the Sudarshan Chakra of Vishnu. And that is Vishnu. Nothing else, no one else can protect you. Even myself. He flew to Vaikuntha. What kind of a powerful personality is he? It took him a year to get there. But that's not that much. When he arrived in Vaikuntha, he fell at the lotus feet of Lord Narayan and prayed, please help me. Lord Narayan said that the sadhu, my devotee, he has surrendered his life to me. He knows nothing but me. Therefore, I surrender to my devotee, and I know nothing more than my devotee. Krishna reciprocates with how we approach him. Because my devotee loves me as the dearmost object of his heart, therefore I naturally love the devotee as the dearmost object of my heart. Because you have offended a great Vaishnava like Ambarish Maharaj, therefore I have no power to help you. Only he could save you. If you fall at his feet and beg for his mercy, then only could I retract the Sudarshan Chakra. Otherwise, I'm powerless to do so. You have offended a Vaishnava. Durvas Muni then understood what is the glories of a devotee. He came back to Ambarish Maharaj. By this time a whole year had passed when he came back. He fell at Ambarish Maharaj's lotus feet. During that whole year, Ambarish Maharaj didn't eat anything. He only drank some water. Because he felt, my guest still hasn't taken prasad, so I cannot eat. Such a person. Durvas Muni says, please forgive me. And Ambarish Maharaj began to offer beautiful prayers to Sudarshan Chakra, the glorious, effulgent devotee of the Lord who protects the Lord's devotees. O effulgent Sudarshan, please forgive Durvas Muni. He prayed to Lord Vishnu, please forgive Durvas Muni. In fact, a devotee like Ambarish Maharaj feels any problems, any sins that are on him, let me suffer his sins, but forgive him. When Durvas Muni saw and heard the prayers of Ambarish, he understood, this is spiritual advancement. Not creating fiery demons, not reading people's minds, not flying all over the universe and beyond. This is sense gratification. What is real spiritual substance is humility, devotion, compassion. These are real spiritual qualities. And a person who develops these qualities are always under the protection of the Lord. And that person and that person alone is considered by Krishna to be Mahatma. Within this world, we can conceive of so many ideas of who is a Mahatma. But Krishna, he is the absolute truth. Param Satyam Dhimahi. We meditate on Krishna because he is the absolute truth. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. And his version of what a Mahatma is perfect. O son of Pritha, those who are not deluded, the great soul, Mahatma, are under the protection of the divine nature. They are fully engaged in devotional service because they know me as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, original and inexhaustible. Thank you very much. Is there any questions? Sanjamali Maharajji, Hare Krishna.
The statement about Super Soul, it's also mentioned that Yamaraj is considered second Super Soul. Yamaraj, the Lord of Death. Does he also have equal power with Super Soul?
No. But he is the Paramatma gives him power to know the sins of all sinners within the universe. So he's given certain of the powers of Super Soul, but he's given not by his own capacity, but he's given it to facilitate his service by the Paramatma, Sri Vishnu. Krishna is the controller of all controllers. The Yamadutas were under this confusion too. When Ajamil was such a sinful person. He was doing all kinds of dastardly deeds to support his prostitute wife. But when he was on the verge of death, Yamadutas came. Yamaraja sent us for you. And Yamadutas, you don't want to see them at the time of death. We may have already seen them many times before, but it's so horrible that our mind just blanks it out. We can't even conceive of it. It's terrible. They're not pretty people. The beginning of the sufferings of Yamalaya, the abode of Yamaraj, is the first glimpse of the people who live there. The Yamadutas. Actually, the section where Yamaraj lives is like a heaven. But that's not where sinners get to go. They get to go to the areas specifically designated for them. But then Vishnudutas came because he chanted the name of Narayan, calling for his son. And there was an argument between Vishnudutas and Yamadutas, and the Vishnudutas were so powerful and so intelligent that the Yamadutas were defeated. They were confused, bewildered, even suicidal. How is it that anyone could have more power than Yamaraj? We are Yamaraj's deputed agents. We are his representatives. We have all his power behind us. How is it that anyone has more authority than him? They presented these doubts to Yamaraj. Yamaraj said, no. Myself, Lord Shiva, Lord Brahma, Indra, everyone is a subordinate servant of Lord Vishnu. He is supreme. All of our powers are coming from him. And he loves his devotees more than he loves his own life. So therefore, never even look in the direction of anyone who has ever once bowed his head before the deity of Krishna. Never even look in the direction of anyone who has even once sincerely chanted the holy names of Krishna. Because if you do, Vishnu will beat upon you with his club. Hare Krishna. So Yamaraj himself explains that yes, he has many of the powers of Paramatma, but they're not his powers. They're the powers of Paramatma that are temporarily given to him for his service by Paramatma Krishna himself. Is there another question?
Yes. Fasting that Maharaj Ambarish did it last for a year or once a year does that fast? That was
every Ekadasi for one full year. He did Nirjali Ekadasi for one full year in Madhuban, which is a forest of Vrindavan. Yes?
In your discourse, you mentioned how the individual soul misuses his volition, his free will, his volition. And we also understand within the doctrine of karma, there's it somewhat implies predestination. So, how are we to understand the concept of free will and predestination according to the laws of karma? Because it seems to be apparent. Paradox.
It begins with our free will, and then we implicate ourselves in the network of karma, and that the karmic reactions that come upon us very strongly influence how we're thinking, how we're feeling, and how we're willing. So in that sense, we are predestined to enjoy or suffer in certain ways, and to even perceive our enjoying and suffering in certain ways due to our previous activities and the karma which it has incurred. But still, even within that situation, we have the freedom to perceive it differently. We may not have the freedom to avoid the reactions, but we do have the freedom of how we're going to react to the reactions. And that will determine whether we become purified from the experience or whether we incur more reactions. Just like somebody comes and insults you, that insult is probably because you insulted somebody in the past, and it's that person is not really the criminal. In one sense, he is, because he's going to have to suffer the reaction of chastising you or harassing you in the future. But he's also delivering to you the results that have to come to you. Now, how are you going to react? You could be forgiving, tolerant, and think, I deserve worse. Let me just chant Hare Krishna. Or you can say, what are you saying, you rascal, you blankety blank blank blank? That's the way they talk here in America, isn't it? So if you say these things, then somebody in the future, somebody's going to come and harass you even more. But if you're forgiving, if you're tolerant, then you're freed from that reaction. Then you're on the route back home, back to Godhead, rather than on the route to further and greater types of incrimination and predestined sufferings. What's coming to you now is predestined by your actions of the past. But what you'll get in the future is what you do now. Hare Krishna. Yes.
Maharaj, you gave the example of Ajamila. Sometimes what happens is when we give this example to people, they tend to misunderstand it and they question that, isn't it unfair that a person who's performing misdeeds for in his life and in the end he just chants the name of Narayana just because he happens to be his son and Krishna protects him? So even though we understand that actually he did some pious deeds before, so that was the reason Krishna protected him, but how actually should we put it so that it is not misinterpreted?
You should explain to people this is the power of the chanting of the holy name of God. Therefore, you should daily chant Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna,
Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama,
Hare Hare.
This is the principle that this story is trying to prove to people. The glorious power of the chanting of the holy name. That somehow or other, if you can chant the holy name at the time of death, you can be delivered. But you cannot depend on such a extraordinary situation as Ajamil. He happened to be a great devotee when he was a child and a young man. But somehow or other, due to the association of this low-class lady, he became polluted. But previously, he was a very chaste and faithful Brahmin and a very religious man. So because of his past sincere devotion, the Lord actually tricked him into giving his son the name Narayan, knowing that he would be too much. Hare Krishna.
One more question.
This lady has a question.
Maharaj, the qualities of devotee like humility, compassion and devotion, does one develop them only by chanting or does one have to make an active effort? Because when I ask this question to some devotees, they're like, why are you worried about developing all these qualities? Just chant and you'll get all of them. Combined effort?
It is combined effort. Because unless you're trying to develop these qualities, you cannot properly chant. We have to guard against the 10 offenses. If we're chanting offensively, our chanting has minimal effect to purify us. No doubt, any chanting, even unfavorable chanting will have some purification, but it's minimal. But if we chant offenselessly, then we're liberated. And you cannot chant offenselessly unless you're humble, self-controlled, respectful to all. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught Trinarupi Sunichena Tarorapi Sahishnana Amanina Manadena Kirtaniya Sadahari. And how did he explain this verse? Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami says that we should take this verse and we should put it on the string of the holy name and wear it always. What does that mean? That means this verse has to be practiced simultaneous to chanting the holy names. We have to live by this verse, and then our chanting will have the real effect of pleasing and attracting the mercy of Krishna. So you must do these things simultaneously. Just by chanting Hare Krishna, it may take hundreds of births to become liberated, what to speak of getting pure love of God. But if we follow the regulative principles and we live by this verse, Trinarupi Sunichena, then the chanting of the holy name will bring you to the spiritual world in this very life. Yes?
Just on that same point, does that verse, Trinarupi Sunichena, include the 26 qualities of the devotee? Would that be included in that verse as the full definition?
By chanting the holy names and following the principles of that verse, then all the 26 qualities of a devotee will naturally manifest for him. Yes?
Maharaj, you said that Yamad has same power as Paramatma has.
No. He's given some similar powers.
Doesn't misuse it, because if you see, demigods are
influenced
by modes of material nature.
But the Yamaraj in this universe is a Mahajan. He's a pure devotee. He's a pure unalloyed Vaishnava. He does not misuse his powers. Krishna knew that it's a very difficult job that he has. Just like some of you have your jobs and you like to take some vacation and go to New Vrindavan. Well, Krishna gave Yamaraj a vacation and he allowed him to take birth as Vidura. And what kind of a Vaishnava was Vidura? He was greatest Vaishnava. He was an ocean of compassion, tolerance, humility, and love. Duryodhana cooked a massive feast of the most delicious preparations in the whole kingdom. And Krishna just walked right by his palace and went to the home of Vidura. Vidura didn't prepare anything. He wasn't even expecting Krishna. It is said by some that Vidura and his wife, they gave him, all they had was some bananas. And they were so nervous, they threw away the banana and gave Krishna the peel. And Krishna ate it, weeping in ecstasy. So delicious is the bhakti in this banana peel. Ah, this is Vidura. So when we talk about Vidura and see his qualities, this is the inner heart of Yamaraj. When Yamaraj is doing his job, it's hard to see his inner heart. Because that's the service that he has to do. But his inner heart is revealed by Vidura. Yes?
Yeah, when I first came to the temple, I talked to Shankar, and I brought two books with me. One was the interpretations of the Bhagavad Gita by Sri Yukteswar, which was Paramahansa Yogananda's guru. And another one was an interpretation of the Bhagavad Gita by Lahiri Mahashya, who was the first disciple of Babaji. I don't know if I'm sure you're familiar with it. And one of the rules and regulations is not to blaspheme the Vedic literature. So, and they talk about the Kriya techniques and how it cuts in half, like millions of years of evolution, previous soul and all this. And they were saying how you can develop Krishna. You know, they're basically saying that they are Krishna. All right, Paramahansa Yogananda, would he be considered like blasphemy or revolution? Giving interpretation.
They have all done good work. Why should we unnecessarily try to find faults with people? They're transcendentalists, no doubt. But they're obviously not on the highest path of perfection, because they haven't understood that bhakti, or pure, unalloyed, unconditional devotion, is supreme. Kriya Yoga, Durvas Muni did Kriya Yoga too. You get powers, and Durvas Muni, we give all respects to him. Don't blaspheme Durvas Muni. Please. He's also dear to Krishna. But we don't want what he has. We want what Ambarish has. And therefore we'll read the books that will give us that. Otherwise we get distracted.
That's what I was reading before I came here.
I think most of us were reading so many things before we came here. But because we had sincere desire in our hearts, somehow or other Krishna directed us to the pure path of bhakti, which Prabhupada is so wonderfully giving freely in Bhagavad Gita as it is. So when we come to that, then if we want that bhakti, we have to exclusively cultivate that. If we simultaneously cultivate those ideologies that distract us from bhakti, then we will not get that bhakti. So there's no reason for us to find fault or to criticize. We just understand that they may have helped you to come ultimately. So we can feel some gratitude to everybody who has helped us. But when do we come to that state? In my own life, many holy men of different varieties of people helped me a lot. And ultimately I came to Srila Prabhupada's lotus feet. And whether they actually helped me to come to Prabhupada, who am I to say? Ultimately Krishna brought me. It's his causeless mercy. But they did help me on some levels. So therefore let me be grateful to anyone who's ever helped me in any way, in any time in my life. I'm grateful to my parents. They didn't give me bhakti, but they fed me. I would have starved to death when I was a baby if they didn't feed me. They provided for me. Any friend in my life who ever helped me in any way, I should be grateful. A Vaishnava is grateful. So why should we criticize anyone who has helped us? But at the same time, we have to discriminate and understand, now that we have come to the path of bhakti, we should not let anything distract our attention away from that. We can be grateful and offer obeisances to all the Durvasa Munis. But we don't want to hear from them, because what they're speaking is something else. They may be speaking something impersonal. They may be speaking about mystic powers that are allurements that take our attention away. Rupa Goswami explains that Karmakanda, Jnanakanda, all these principles, trying to follow religious principles for material enjoyment, or even for mystic power, or for liberation, they're all distractions from bhakti. We have to cultivate exclusive devotion. And that's what Lord Chaitanya and his followers have given us. And that's what we find in Bhagavad Gita as it is. Prabhupada has translated it, so he extracts the essence of Gita and presents it on every page. So therefore, I had so many Bhagavad Gitas and so many others, and I gave them away, and I accepted Prabhupada's Gita.
I have one more question.
Yes? Does that answer your question?
One more. It's probably insignificant, but there's like a saying in India, there's an incarnation on every corner. Incarnation.
And halfway down each block, too.
If it's not in the Vedas, if it's not prophesied in the Vedas that these incarnations are coming, then they're not true incarnations. Because in Autobiography Yogi, it says, Yuyaktezwa, incarnation of wisdom, and then Babaji is the Maha Avatar, and this and this and this.
Sometimes people, when they embody a certain quality, we may say they're an incarnation of that quality. But an actual incarnation of the Lord, those particular personalities are specifically explained within the Vedic literatures. And in this age of Kali Yuga, Buddha was an incarnation of Lord. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was the incarnation, was the Yuga Avatar, teaching the recommended process for the age. And then in another 427,000 years from now, Kalki Avatar will come and do his work. Yes. Yes. Best if we go back to Godhead before we see him. He's a beautiful personality. So these are the incarnations within this age of Kali. And if others claim themselves to be incarnations of God, we understand that anyone can say anything. And having certain powers is not the qualification of an incarnate. Durvasa Muni had such powers. Does anyone today have powers like him?
They said Babaji made palaces materialize and this and this, and his state of being is inconceivable, even this and this, and he's
That is not the qualification of an incarnation. Mystics can do that too. Mystics could do that too.
Ravana made a whole gold city on an airplane or something.
Ravana? Kardama Muni? Kardama Muni was just a simple, humble devotee. But he had some mystic powers. He made an airplane that had a city more opulent than the heavenly planets that could fly all over the universe. But yet, Kardama Muni considered himself to be the most insignificant servant of Lord Vishnu, because he was an honest person. He was an honest mystic. Somebody else makes a few ashes and says, I am God. So we are not concerned with that. We are concerned with the highest truth. And those who represent that truth. Thank you very much. So will we have Arti now? Or should we have... Yes?
During the discussion, we were saying that we should be very careful with how we use the devotee. Never offend them. Like, what is the case of your spouse? Even if he's a devotee, but you're more casual in your relationship with your spouse. So, is the offense just as great?
I'll answer your question in such a way that I think you'll understand. For that reason, I took sannyas. Yes, if you offend your spouse, that's Vaishnava Aparad. No doubt. If you abuse or misuse your spouse, whether it's your husband or your wife, that's Vaishnava Aparad, and you have to suffer the consequence. So we should be very careful. We should develop respect toward each other. But because of that familiarity, sometimes there's little battles at home. I've heard about these things. But we should, when the anger subsides, the person who's willing to first come first to apologize and make things right will get the most mercy from Krishna. So we should forgive. We should beg forgiveness, and we should be willing to forgive. And that will maintain a spiritual sanctity within the relationship. Does that answer your question? Yes, Shankar Pandit Prabhu.
Dr. Ram is a scientist, and he has a question, but I think he's feeling reluctance to ask the question.
Well, in fact, I used to ask the question.
That must be why you're reluctant.
But I found that asking hundreds of the Swamis, I never got an answer. So I thought this question and answer will come from within yourself when the time will come. And I'm waiting for the time when it will come, and I will get to reveal myself what the answer is.
That's all right. But you may find that when it's revealed within yourself, it's the same thing that the sadhu said.
I don't know.
You may find that.
When I get the answer, I will call you.
Thank you very much. That was the easiest question I ever got.
I stop asking questions, though I won't ask questions today, at least, you know. if Shankar is asking me to ask a question, right? Well, if he's asking, then I will ask on his behalf, that's fine.
Should be something.
Hearing you, it was very pleasant.
Thank you.
The first time I have found that somebody from ISKCON who does not believe in criticism. Many times I found Swamis from ISKCON, they start from criticizing others. I'm very pleased to hear that one. In particular, Swamis criticize scientists, Swamis criticize other brought Babaji, and he called Mahavatar. He spoke, Yukteswar Maharaj, he spoke, Lahiri Mahasa, he spoke, Paramahansa. So, I'm happy to know this one, that you did not criticize, but you appreciated that everybody helped to bring you or somebody to this place. And that's very good. So, tell me, if you can, why Prabhupada criticized scientists too much? Is there any reason?
And Dr. Ram is a scientist.
Prabhupada did not criticize scientists. Just like if you go to a doctor who is a surgeon, and that doctor says to you that there is a disease that has to be removed. There's a cancerous tumor in your throat that has to be removed. Do you say, "Why are you criticizing me? I have a very nice throat." Prabhupada was not actually criticizing. Rather, he was pointing out the illusion that they were under, and he wanted to remove that illusion. In fact, Prabhupada established the Bhaktivedanta Institute, and he put more funding and more energy into the Bhaktivedanta Institute than practically any other project within ISKCON besides a few construction projects in India. And they're all scientists. But they're trying to prove the existence of God through science. And they're trying to create an environment by which science, through knowledge of material energy and its interreactions and understanding of its connections to the soul and to the super soul, will inspire devotion in people's hearts rather than atheism in people's hearts. Prabhupada did not criticize, I don't believe, but he wanted to remove the principle of atheism that was misleading people away from God, that was being delineated by scientists. But any scientist who was promoting truth on the basis of God is our creator, I'm not the creator, Prabhupada was very, very much appreciative of that.
I found Wolf classical school today.
Yes.
And most of the Prabhupada's
scientists. Yes.
How you come back?
Same thing. Prabhupada is like a father. If a child misbehaves, you may call your child a rascal. But do you hate the child, or do you hate his rascaldom? Prabhupada invented that word, rascaldom. Which means the behavior of a rascal. Prabhupada loved every living being. He saw Krishna in everyone's heart. But he saw that people were suffering terribly due to forgetfulness of Krishna, and they were promoting that worldwide. So you hate the disease, but you don't hate the diseased. If your mother has a disease, you don't hate your mother, but you do hate the disease that's causing her so much suffering. That's compassion. And when those diseased people are spreading like an epidemic, the disease, then you have to make people aware that it is a disease. Or as it is said in Christian religion, hate the sin, but not the sinner. So Prabhupada was calling the sin rascal. But the person he actually saw that is an eternal servant of Krishna, that is just covered by this rascal mentality. And like a good surgeon, I just had surgery 11 days ago. And it's sore. That's why I'm moving around a little. But do I tell my surgeon that, why did you blaspheme me? This is Vaishnava Parad, you cut me open with a knife? If an ordinary person cut me open with a knife, if I was a Vaishnav, that is, I'm not, but if I was a Vaishnav, if he cut me open with a knife, that would be Vaishnav Aparad. But when a surgeon does it, it's not Vaishnav Aparad, it's Vaishnav Seva. It's service. So Prabhupada, sometimes he used words that were like scalpels, that were like surgical instruments. To remove disease. But he wasn't offending people, really. He wasn't doing it in an offensive way. He was doing it like a surgeon. He was actually doing it to serve the scientists, to serve humanity. And because we see it that way and we understand it that way, that's why we want to give our life for such a person.
I'm very satisfied with your answer. I guess first time somebody...
Thank you.
treat you and to the way a surgeon does for patients. However, when I hear or read the books, I had a different perception. Maybe I didn't meet you before. I'll try to proceed the way you said, see how this works. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I give this credit to Shankar
for it. I will also give all credit to Shankar. Actually, this is what he taught me. By his very behavior and by his good qualities, we learn so many essential truths of Krishna consciousness.
You are jeopardizing his reputation to Shankar Pandit on behalf of that run.
In fact, my coming is here just because of him. And let me tell you, I went to temple and he asked me, are you coming to Bharat Fest? I said, no. He said, why? I said, I do not have time because today I came to know very late. But when I was coming, he was driving, and I guess he honked me three times at one car. Then I said to my wife, who is this person? And by the way, he and I stopped our car just parallel. And then when I turned, I saw his circle on it, and he again asked me. And then when I was driving, I think I did not give him any answer that whether I'm coming or not, but when I was coming, then I was following him. I thought, he's doing a good job. He reminded me three times, four times, so he's very good. And I know he's my well-wisher for the last 10 years at least, right? So let's follow Shankar Pandit and go. So I'm really thankful to you as well as Shankar Pandit.
The moral to your story is we should all follow Shankar Pandit. Prabhu. Thank you very much. I thank everyone very much for your kindness upon me. Hare Krishna. Is it Prasad or Arti? Srila Prabhupada ki. Yeah.